demons, devils, and the such? Again the shake of his head. It's hard to understand. She shrugged. How so? Isn't hell simply the unknown? Any terrible place or region of which nothing is understood? To the traveller tribes, it lay across the mountains in Starside, while to the Vampiri, it waited on the other side of the Sphere Gate. Certainly it must be horrible and lethal beyond that gate, for no one had ever returned to tell of it. That was how the Vampiri saw it. I saw it that way too in the days before Zek and Jazz and you and your son. And don't forget, Harry, even the Vampiri were once men. However monstrous a man may grow, still he'll remember the night fears in his childhood. Shaitan, Harry mused. A mystery spanning two worlds. The legend was taken into my world by banished Vampiri lords and occasionally their traveller retainers when they were sent through Starside's gate. But in his own mind, oh really? Or is the so-called legend more properly universal? The great evil, the lord of lies, of all wickedness. What of the similarity in the names? Satan, Shaitan, and their devils in all the universes of light. And what of angels? Better stop thinking of him as a legend, Karen warned, as if she'd been listening to his thoughts, which she had not. The Dweller says he's real and coming here, which means that in order to live we have to kill him. Except if Shaitan has already lived for how long? 2,000-3,000 years. Is it even reasonable to believe that we can kill him? Harry had scarcely heard her. He was still working things out. How many of them? He finally asked. Shaitan will be their leader, and Shaithas with him. But who else?
Survivors from the battle at the garden, Karen answered. If they also survive the Icelands.
I remember, Harry said. We've considered them before. Fess Ferenc, Vuls Pinisku, Arcus Leperson, and their thralls. No more than a handful, or, if others of the old lords survive the ordeal of exile, a large handful. He drew himself up. But I am still the Necroscope. And again I say, can they come and go through the Mobius Continuum? Can they call up the dead out of their graves? And once more to himself, can you, Harry? Can you?
Shaitan may have the art, she answered. For after all, he was the first of the Vampiri. Since when, he has had time enough for studying. It's possible he can torment the dead for their secrets.
But will they answer? Harry growled, his eyes glowing like rubies in the firelight. No, no, I didn't mean necromancy, but necroscopy. A necromancer may examine a corpse or even a long-dead mummy, but I talk to the very spirits of the dead. And they love me. Indeed, they'll rise up from their dust for me.
A lie. You even lie to yourself now. You are Vampiri, Harry Keogh. Call up the dead.
Ah, you used to. You used to. He started to his feet. I have to try, and went down to Starside's foothills under the garden, where long ago he called up an army of mummified trogs to do battle with the Vampiri trogs. He talked to their spirits in his fashion, but only the wind out of the north answered him. He sensed that they were there and heard him, but they kept silent. They were at peace now. Why should they join the Necroscope in his turmoil? He went up into the garden. There were graves, far too many of them, but untended now. Travellers who died in the great battle, trogs laid to rest in niches under the crags. They heard him too, and remembered him well, but they felt something different in him, which wasn't to their liking. Ah, Vampiri. Necromancer. This man or monster had words which could call them to a horrid semblance of life, even against their will.
And I might,
he threatened, sensing their refusal, their terror. But from within,
what, like Janus Forenzi? What price now your humanity, Harry?
He went back to the eerie, to Karen, and told her bleakly, once I could have commanded an army of the dead. Now there are just the two of us.
Three.
The Dweller's growl was in their minds, but clear as if he stood beside them.
You fought with me, both of you, for my cause. My turn now.
That seemed to decide it,
to state their case, set their course, even though it's the only course they'd ever had. Karen fetched her gauntlet and dipped it in a cleansing acid solution, then set to oiling its joints.
"Me," she said, "I tore the living heart out of Les the Glut. Aye, and there was a lot more to fear in those days. And it dawns on me, I'm not afraid for myself, but for the loss of what we have. Except, when you look at it, well, what do we have after all?"
Harry jumped up, strode to and fro, shaking his fists and raging inside and out, and then grew deadly calm. It was his vampire, of course, still seeking ascendancy. He nodded knowingly and grunted.
"Well, and maybe I've kept you down long enough.
Perhaps it's time I let you out." "What?"
Karen looked up from the working of her gauntlet.
"Nothing."
"Nothing?" She arched her eyebrows. "I only ask, where shall it be?"
"The garden," said the dweller,
far away in the mountains. They heard him, and Karen agreed.
"Aye, the garden has its merits. We know it well anyway."
Finally, with a furious nod, the necroscope surrendered to his vampire. In part, at least.
"Very well,"
he snarled.
"The garden, so be it."
And so it would be. In Starside, it was the hour when all that remains of the furnace sun is a smudgy grey luminosity in a sky gnawed by jutting fangs of mountain, and the nameless stars are chunks of alien ice freezing in weird orbits. The deepest, darkest hour of sundown, and the last of the Vampiri, Scythus and Shaitan, Harry Keogh and Karen were coming together to do battle in an empty place once called the Garden. All four of them the last of their race, and the Dweller, too, except he was no longer Vampiri as such, or if he was, even his vampire scarcely knew it. Karen had known for some time now that the invaders were close and closing on Starside, ever since her creatures, out on the rim of the rimmy ocean, called to her one last time to pass on that information before they died. And, as they died, so Karen had asked them,
"How many are the enemy, and what are their shapes?"
It was easier far to gauge strength and substance that way than from complicated descriptions. The distance was great, and the brains of warriors were never too large, unwise to invest such masses of menace with other than the most rudimentary intelligence. Nevertheless, vague pictures of flyers, warriors, and controlling beings had come back, pain etched out of the north, showing Karen how small was the army of Shaitan. It consisted only of a pair of controlling lords who rode upon massive flyers with scale-plated heads and underbellies, and a half-dozen warriors of generally unorthodox construction. Unorthodox, aye, to say the least. For the invaders, who should only be Scythus and Shaitan the Fallen, though Karen held back from any kind of direct contact with their minds, had apparently seen fit to break all the olden rules of the Vampiri in fashioning three of these beasts. For one, they had organs of generation, much like Karen's constructs, and for another, they seemed to act much of their own accord, without the guidance of their supposed controllers. Lastly, one of them was a monster even among monsters, so much so that Karen didn't even care to dwell upon it. At first, she was informed, there had been an extra pair of flyers, weary beasts whose riders landed them in deep drifts close to the edge of the ocean. Alighting, the Vampiri lords had then called down their warriors and fresh flyers out of the sky, allowing them to fuel themselves on the exhausted bodies of these first mounts. And while they were busy with their food, that was when Karen's guardian creatures had attacked, only to discover the overwhelming ferocity and superiority of Shaitan's warriors. That was a message which the last of Karen's beasts conveyed to her, before its feeble mind-sendings were swamped by dull pain and quickly extinguished. Harry had been asleep at that time, racked by nightmares. Karen had watched him tossing and turning, and listened to him mouthing of the cone-shaped universes of light, and of Mobius, a wizard he'd known in the Helllands, a mathematician who got religion, a madman who believes God is an equation, which is more or less what Pythagoras believed, but centuries before him, and of the Mobius Continuum, that fabulous, fathomless place where he'd made metamorphic love to her, and which he now considered an infinite brain controlling the bodies of universes, in which simple beings such as myself are mere synapses conveying thoughts and intentions, and perhaps carrying out someone's will. And then the necroscope's dream had been a feverish thing, full of thoughts, conversations, and associations out of his past, even past dreams, all tangled into a kaleidoscope of the real and surreal, where his life from its onset was observed to have been metamorphic, as his flesh in the way it had burst open to sprout weird discoveries and concepts. The dream contained, even as a dying man's last breath is said to contain, crucial elements of that entire life, but concertinaed into a single vision of mere moments. When the cold sweat started on his grey brow, Karen might have gently awakened him, except his words fascinated her, and anyway, he needed to sleep, in order to be strong for the coming battle. Perhaps he would settle down again when the nightmare was past, and so she sat by him while he sweated and raved of things quite beyond her conception, about time's relativity and all history, that of the future as well as the past, being contemporary but occurring in some strange elsewhere, and about the dead, the real dead, not the undead, waiting patiently in their graves for a new beginning, their second coming, and about a great light, the primal light, which is the ongoing, unending, bigger bang as all the universes expand forever out of darkness. He mumbled about numbers with the power to separate space and time, and of a metaphysical equation whose only justification is to extend mind beyond the span of the merely physical. On one level, it was the subconscious whirlpool of Harry's instinctive mathematical genius, enhanced by his now ascendant vampire, while on a higher plane it was a violent confrontation between two entirely elemental powers, darkness and light, good and evil, knowledge for its own sake, which is a sin, and the total absence of knowledge, which is innocence. It was the necroscope's subconscious battle with himself, within himself, which must be fought and won lest the final darkness fall. For Harry himself would be the bright guardian of worlds still to come, or their utter destruction before they were even born. But Karen didn't know any of that, only that she mustn't wake him just yet. And Harry fevered on. "I could give you formula you haven't even dreamed of," he sneered out of some all but forgotten pastime, while the lights of his eyes burned scarlet through lowered, frantically fluttering lids. "An eye for an eye, Dragusani, and a tooth for a tooth. I was Harry Keogh, become my own son's sixth sense, before Alec Kyle's emptied head sucked me in and made his body mine. The great liar Faithor would have lived in there with me. But where's Faithor now, eh? And where's Thibor? And what of the Badescu brat and Janus?" Suddenly he sobbed, and great tears squeezed themselves out from under his luminous eyelids. "And Brenda, Sandra, Penny, am I cursed or blessed? And I had a million friends, which would be fine except they were all dead. They lived in a dimension beyond life, where I could still talk to them, and they could still remember what it was to have been alive. There are many dimensions, planes of existence without number, worlds without end, the myriad cone-shaped universes of light, and I know how they came about. And Mobius knew it before me. Pythagoras might have guessed something of it, but Mobius and I know. Let there be," he screwed up his tightly closed eyes. "Let there be." Great slugs of sweat oozed out of his shuddering lead-grey body. "Let there be!" Until Karen could stand his pain, for this could only be pain, no longer, and clutching him where he writhed upon her bed, she begged him. "Let there be what, Harry?"
"Light!"
he growled, and his furious eyes shot open aglow with their own heat.
"Light!"
she repeated him, her voice full of wonder. He struggled to sit up, gave in, and let himself sink down into her arms. And he looked at her, nodded, and said, "Yes, the primal light which shone out of his mind." Harry's eyes had always been weird, even before his vampire stained them with blood, but now they were changing from moment to moment. Karen saw the fury go out of them, then the fear, and watched fascinated as all alien vitality, even the very passion of the Vampiri, died in them. For with only one exception, the necroscope was the first of his sort to know and believe.
"His mind?" Karen repeated him at last, wondering at the softness of his face, which was that of a child. "The mind of God?"
Even now Harry couldn't be absolutely certain, but near enough.
"Of a god, anyway," he finally told her, smiling. "A creator!"
And inside him, instinctively aware of looming defeat, his vampire shrank down and was small, and perhaps bemoaned its fate, to be one with a man who only desired to be a man.
Chapter 6 Sky Fight. From then on, the necroscope had been different. His parasite's ascendancy had been reversed. Once again, his humanity had the upper hand. Karen, to the contrary, she tried to insist that he accompany her on raids into Sunside for blood himself. Naturally, he would hear nothing of it, and she would be furious.
"But you're not blooded," she growled at him as they made love. "There's a frenzy in the Vampiri which only blood will release, for the blood is the life. Unless you take, you may not partake in your fullness. You must fuel yourself for the fight. Can't you see that? How may I explain?"
But in fact, there was no need for explanations. Harry knew well enough what she meant. He'd seen it in his own world, in boxers the moment they draw blood, how the fight sight and smell of it inspires them to greater efforts, so that they go at their opponents with even more determination, and always hammering away at the same wet red gleaming spot. He'd seen it in cats, large and small, the first splash of mouse blood which turns a kitten to a hunter, or drives the hunter to a frenzy. And as for sharks, nothing else in all their unexplored span of their lives has half so much meaning for them.
"But I've eaten well," he would answer. And, "Ha!" he would hear her mental snort of derision. "Of what? The flesh of pigs and roasted? What's that for fuel?"
"It fuels me well enough."
"And your vampire not at all?"
"Then let the bastard starve."
But he would never allow himself the luxury of greater anger than that. Sometimes he would try to explain. "What's coming is coming," he told her. "Didn't we see it in the Mobius Continuum, in future time? Of all the lessons of my life, Karen, this is the one I've learned the best. Never to try to change or avoid what's written in the future, for it is written. All we can hope for is a better understanding of the writing, that's all." Again her snort. And bitterly,
"And now who is beaten, even before the fight?"
"Do you think I don't feel tempted?" he said then.
"Oh, I do, believe me. But I've fought this thing inside me for such a long time now that I can't just let it win, no matter the cost. If I succumbed to rage and lust, went out and took the life of a man and drained his blood, what then? Would it give me the strength I need to destroy Scythus and Shaitan? Perhaps, but who would be next after them? How long before I started the Vampiri cycle all over again, but strong this time as never before, with all the powers of a necroscope to play with? And with my vampire's bloodlust raging, what then? Do you think I wouldn't begin to look for a way back into my own world? To return there as the greatest plague-bearer of all time?"
"Perhaps you'd be a king there," she answered, "with me to share your bone throne."
He nodded, but wryly. "The Red King, aye. And eventually emperor of a scarlet dynasty, and all of our undead lieutenants, our blood sons and those who got our vampire eggs, and their sons and daughters, all of them pouring their pus on a crumbling mankind, building their Ares and carving kingdoms of their own, as Janus would have done from his Mediterranean island, and Thibor the warlord after he had turned Wallachia red, or Faethor on his blood-crazed crusades. And all of our progeny necroscopes in their own right, with neither the living nor the dead safe from them. Hell lands? Now you're talking, Karen." Following which, he wouldn't even listen to her, But even if he had, it would have been too late. For that was when Charon's other watchers, great Demodus bats from the Eris colony, brought news of the arrival on Starside's far northern borders of Shaitan and his small but deadly aerial forces. Inaudible except to Charon and to others of their own genus, the cries of the great vampires relayed the message back across several hundred miles of barren boulder plains. The fact that after 4 years of peace, the old Vampiri were finally returning to Starside. She was bringing mewling warriors out of their vats when the warning arrived, and went straight to Harry where he stood wrapped in his thoughts on a balcony facing north.
"Stand there long enough, Necroscope," she told him, "and you'll be able to wave them a welcome, nor will you have to wait too long."
He barely glanced at her, acknowledged her presence with a nod. "I know they're here," he said. "I felt them coming like maggots chewing on the ends of my nerves. They're not so many, but they shake the ether like an army shakes the earth. It's time we went to the garden."
"You go," she told him, touching his arm as some of the sting went out of her voice. "See if you can call down your son out of the hills. Maybe he'll bring the Grey Brotherhood with him, though what good they'll be is hard to say. But me, I've a trio of warriors to wean and instruct. They're built of fine, fierce stuff, right enough. Good stuff left behind by Menor Membite and Lesk the Glut, which I found intact under the ruins of their stacks. But when it comes to fashioning, well, it's true I'm a novice compared to them."
"Just make sure they'll own me as their master as well as yourself," was Harry's reply. "That way, even if they haven't the measure of Shaitan's creatures, still I might be able to come up with a trick or two."
Then he turned and caught her up so swiftly in his arms that she gasped aloud. And, "Charon," he said, "we've seen our futures, the red threads of our lives melting into golden fire, then fading to nothing. It didn't look too good for us, but at the same time it could mean anything. We simply don't understand it, and in any case, whatever it means, it has to be better than what we saw of our enemies' futures, for they didn't have any. No scarlet threads in Starside's tomorrows, Charon."
"I remember," she said, without freeing herself, pressing more firmly to him. "And so I stay and fight. Whatever becomes of us, it's worth it to know that they die too."
Harry held her very close, very tightly, and his looks were even more those of a small boy. He found himself wishing it were all a fantastic dream, and that he'd wake up a schoolboy with all of his future ahead of him, but retaining enough of the dream that he'd make no false moves. Ah, if only things worked that way.
"I wish I'd known you as some ordinary girl on my own world, when I was just a man," he told her, on impulse. Charon wasn't so romantic. She had been an innocent in her time, until she was stolen. Now and then a blushing traveller youth had wanted her, but in those days she'd kept herself, as she'd thought, for something better.
"Ha!" her answer was harsh. "We would be fumbling, giggling lovers for an hour. To hell with it, I prefer what we've had. Anyway, you are the Necroscope. What do you know of ordinary men?"
The fire in her was a catalyst. It burned outwards through her shell to illuminate her as she really was. Vampiri. Harry could be like her, yes. But did he need to be? He'd gone up against Dragasani, Thibor, Yulian Badescu, and all the others as a man, albeit a man with powers. No, never an ordinary man, but neither had he been a monster. And now there were others set against him, but again as a man, or as nearly as possible.
He released her. "Is there a flyer ready?" "In the launching bay, yes. But won't you use the Mobius route?"
He shook his head. "My son and his grey brothers wouldn't see me. He might know in his way, and he might not. Riding a flyer will be visible, a curiosity. Not many flyers in Starside skies these days." At the launching bay, watching him take off in the saddle of the pulsing manta shape which was his flyer, she saw that he was right. Other than himself, the sky was empty. For now. Feeling empty herself, Charon went back to her warriors.
Harry and Charon were together in the garden's desolation when Scythus and Shaitan the Fallen came back into the old Vampiri heartland. But contrary to expectations, the invaders did not launch an immediate attack.
Instead, they came gliding and squirting out of dark, auroral, flickering northern skies, and oh so warily circled the debris-littered plains where the tumbled stacks of extinct vampire lords lay in shattered ruin. Eventually, ever cautious, they landed in the bays of Charon's Eyrie and explored its empty levels, finding nothing inimical, no hidden pitfalls, no hostile creatures waiting in the shadows. But neither did they find gas beasts, siphoneers, servitors of any shape or form. No comforts whatsoever, except perhaps in the strength of the Eyrie's ancient walls, and even these weren't secure enough for Scythus.
"I was a witness to the destruction of greater stacks than this one," he told Shaitan. "My own included."
"Two of them?" the other chuckled, nodding his great black cowl. "It took both Harry Keogh and the Dweller to control the power of the sun that time. Can't you see that? But there is no more Dweller. He's gone, shriveled to a wolf. And as for his father, why, on his own, this pale, unblooded alien is less than a puling child."
"Then why don't we attack, and without delay?"
"We do, but not until we've fueled our beasts and filled our own bellies. Then, after we've rested our bones a little, and perhaps seen to other needs too long denied, that will be soon enough. For we've come a long, cold, weary way, Scythus, and not merely to dispose of this hated enemy of yours, or to let you sate yourself on the flesh of a female who spurned and betrayed you. So calm yourself and be patient, and everything you most desire shall be." But for all Shaitan's apparent confidence, deep in his black heart he too was concerned about their opponent, the so-called Hell-lander Harry Keogh, a vampire who had not yet tasted the blood of other men. Unknown to Scythus, the great leech, which was his ancestor, had already employed his own superior, infinitely furtive vampire powers in a remote, partial examination of the necroscope. Shaitan's telepathy was more advanced than Charon's and Harry's. Indeed, his was the maggot which had gnawed on Harry's nerve endings. Even so, what probes he'd attempted had been perfunctory. The reason was simple. Only penetrate the outermost shell of the necroscope's psychic aura, come within miles of the core of light, the unplumbed, emerging center of power which he must never be allowed to become, and any sensitive being would feel it for himself. As Scythus might if he weren't such a dullard, but such a beautiful dullard and all wasted, for now anyway. That pent energy, which was so much greater than that of a mere man, possibly greater even than that of certain vampires. But energy of what? From where? These were the questions which caused Shaitan's concern, for until he knew what Harry Keogh was, or what he might become, he really couldn't be sure how to deal with him. Far easier, when the time was right, to deal with Scythus, the self-considered devious, Scythus, a very beautiful, very dull, would-be great traitor, who would soon prove himself to be Scythus the great fool. That same Scythus who kept such a tight guard on his mind, lest its vile and treacherous thoughts fly free. Except Shaitan had long ago made himself privy to all of his descendants' thoughts, which were secret no longer. But imprudent to fuss over all that now. Time enough when Starside's weird alien defender was dead or otherwise disposed of, or perhaps earlier, but only if Scythus himself could bring it to a head. These were Shaitan's thoughts, but all kept hidden from Scythus, of course. They left a lone warrior guarding the Eyrie and took the rest with them into Sunside, where soon they spied the fires of a traveller settlement. Then, for a while the night air was filled with the screams of men, the bellowing of warriors and the sounds of their gluttony, also with the hot reek of the freshly dead and with the shrieks of those taken alive. Of the latter, there were six, and they were all women. Later, the higher windows of Charon's Eyrie came flickering alive with the ruddy light of fires. Smoke went up from the chimneys. It was as if a great and merry party took place there. For vampires so long denied, it was merry anyway. What battered, broken titbits were left when Scythus and Shaitan were done went to the warriors for sweetmeats, a small mercy that nothing of that ravished flesh still lived. In the garden, Harry and Charon slept. The necroscope still reckoned time in days and nights. As yet, when his mind told his body it was night, his body's response was to sleep. But in any case, his weirdness would be as much mental as physical, for he knew that in any battle to come he would be fighting himself, no less than the enemy. The problem, which always chased itself in circles until he grew tired, never changed. How to win without calling on his vampire for its assistance, without giving it full rein over the range of its powers? For to allow his leech total ascendancy would be to single his own submission, following which he'd no longer be his own man, but Vampiri in every sense of the word. Karen had no such problem. She already was Vampiri. But before that she'd been a woman, and the necroscope was her man. When he slept, so did she, curled in his arms. They were not totally unprepared, however. They were clothed, and Karen's gauntlet lay close to hand. And, not unmindful of their position, they'd set a watch. A warrior grunted a little, shifting its hugely armoured bulk for comfort where it had been positioned in the shadows beyond the crest of the saddle. Likewise, Karen's second beast, forward in the lee of the wall where the ground fell steeply away to Starside's foothills and the plain beyond. As for the third creature, it was situated at a higher elevation, on a ledge under an overhang in the western crags, where its many night-orientated eyes peered far out across the boulder plains, searching the skies and starlit wastes for any unwarranted movement. But unknown to the sleepers, there was a fourth, far less conspicuous watcher. Once known as the Dweller, now he was a lean grey shape who kept himself apart, observing the unkempt garden from the cover of the ragged tree line. Sometimes, in a flash of memory, he would understand why he had come here, but at others he wasn't quite sure. Anyway, here he was, and it was his snarled mind call, together with a sudden bellowing and screaming of embattled beasts, which startled the necroscope and his lady awake when at last the invaders struck. And, for all their precautions, still they were taken by surprise, for the enemy didn't strike out at Starside at all, but from Sunside over the mountains, where it was still sundown. The invaders had departed Karen's eyrie in full force, crossed the peaks far to the east, where there was no one to observe them, and turned west into the lee of the mountains. Under cover of the Great Barrier Range, their Sunside flight path had followed the spine of the crags to the latitude of the garden, where, rising up over the peaks to look down on the territory of the defenders, they'd carefully noted the locations of the warriors and the fact that nothing else was stirring. Then their probes had discovered Karen's sleeping mind. As for the necroscope's mind, even asleep it had been shielded and impenetrable, and dreaming. Harry dreamed that he sped down from Starside's future time stream. His eyes were full of the dazzle of blue, green, and red lines of life, and his ears seemed tuned to the unending monotone of life's expansion into all of the tomorrows of all the universes of light. Last time he had been with Karen, but this time he was alone, paying more attention to his surroundings and aware of the convergence of scarlet vampire threads upon his own. And just when it seemed they must fuse together in some weird temporal collision, that was the point at which the Mobius time turned gold in that furious melting pot which terminated everything. Maybe not. But that was when his dream terminated, and Harry sprang awake in the ruined traveller dwelling which he and Karen had made their headquarters, and Karen, too, waking up in his arms. "The warriors!" she gasped, expanding her hand to thrust it into the coarse-lined matrix of her gauntlet. "I see," Harry answered, already on his feet and conjuring a Mobius door, which coincided with the door-frame of the stone-fashioned dwelling, and as he stepped through both, so he glanced up at the sky. Up there, flyers. He saw them in the moment before the Mobius continuum enveloped him. Vast manta shapes pulsing on high, from whose saddles Vampiri riders directed the attack of their warriors. But apart from warriors already landed and joining in battle with Karen's creatures, there were several still airborne, squirting across the stars like aerial octopi, their veins extended and propulsion orifices blasting. Three of them in a protective triangle formation around their controllers, but how many were already down? Harry emerged from the continuum at the back of the saddle. Karen's guardian warrior was under attack from two lesser but incredibly ferocious beasts. One was underneath, pincers and sickles working to disembowel, while the other rode its back, biting away through to the spine. Even metamorphic flesh must soon succumb to this.
"Disengage," the necroscope ordered. "Get aloft if you can. Harass the enemy in the sky."
In the order to address the warrior, he had opened his mind. Karen was in at once.
"I've launched the warrior from the ledge of the crags," she immediately informed. "He's fast and fierce. If you can get that one airborne, Scythus and Shaitan may well be disadvantaged. Their flyers are unconventional, heavily armoured, but still no match for warriors. Maybe we can knock the bastards out of the sky."
But now, in close proximity with the enemy, their thoughts were no longer private.
"Ah, Karen,"
Scythus called down gleefully from on high.
"Ever treacherous, eh? Why, I do believe you'd damn me with your last breath. And so you shall, for I shall see to it."
And to Harry growlingly,
"As for you, Hellander, but I remember you well enow. For I had an eyrie upon a time, till you and your dweller son reduced it to so much rubble. But where's your son now, eh? A great wolf, I hear. Siring pups by the light of the moon. And what bitch did you get him out of, eh?"
Harry heard Scythus's sneering clearly enough. Also Shaitan's abrupt interruption, which oozed in his mind like mental slime.
"Taunting serves no purpose. Kill him by all means when the time is right, but until then let it be."
The necroscope's vampire raged. It wanted its way. Its demands on Harry were mental as well as physical, so that he could almost hear it screaming.
"Give me the right. Let me smite them. Only give your mind and body to me, and in my turn I'll give you everything."
But Harry knew it was a lie, and that in fact his parasite would take everything. He heard a buffeting of air, adopted a defensive crouch, and glanced aloft. Karen was already airborne. Harry's flyer, which she had sent, made a tight turn and descended towards him. As the creature's 50-foot span of membranous manta wing, spongy flesh, cartilage, and aviolate bone swooped low overhead, Harry leapt and snatched at the harness fitting under its neck. Another moment and he was hauling himself into the saddle, and on the ground the beleaguered warrior threw off its attacker and squirted aloft.
"Good," Harry told it. "Now get up there with your ugly twin and help him tear those enemy flyers out of the sky."
"Let all assist them," came Karen's mind call as her beast commenced climbing a spiral wind off starside to where the invaders seemed to sit among the stars.
And rising up towards the armoured flyers of Scythus and Shaitan within their arrowhead formation of hissing, throbbing warriors, Harry queried,
"Where's our warrior number 3?
"Dead on the ground, necroscope," Karen answered grimly, "crushed by the most terrible construct I ever saw. In the old days, even to conceive of such a beast would have meant automatic banishment. The old rule was simple, never bring to being anything which might prove difficult to put down, for even the feeblest brain will eventually learn tricks of its own. As for these things which Scythus and Shaitan have devised, especially that one, why, can't you feel their evil intelligence? They are abominations."
Harry looked all around in the sky, finally glanced down through 1,000 feet of dark, empty air, and saw what followed on behind, and,
"I see what you mean," he said.
What he saw was this. Rising alongside Karen and himself in the same section of the spiral, the warrior he had ordered aloft dripped fluids from an underbelly whose scaly armour had been breached. Plasma gouts gleamed red as a ruby necklace where metamorphic tissues were already at work healing deep neck wounds. For the present, the warrior's propulsors blasted as before, but Harry fancied he could detect a spluttering even now. A little higher than he and Karen, and climbing that much faster, the unscathed warrior she'd launched from the crags vented propulsive gases in a fury. It snorted like a dragon where it made an all-too-obvious beeline for the alien flyers and their riders overhead. Responding like monstrous automata to the threat, The trio of escorting warriors turned inwards and began to converge, lost a little height, then fell like stones with their veins angling them towards their target. All of this registered in a moment, the fact that here in the middle air and overhead, Charon and the Necroscope were already gravely outnumbered. As for the situation below, that was worse. The enemy warriors, which had given Charon's creature a mauling at the back of the garden, had launched themselves into the same updraft and were gaining, and coming up even faster behind them was that destroyer of her third creature, which she'd described as the most terrible warrior she'd ever seen. No expert in such things, still Harry had to agree. It had squid-like lines, which was where any comparison with creatures of previous knowledge must break down. Gigantic, it was flesh and blood, cartilage and bone, but it had the look of a grey mottling of some weird flexible metal. Clusters of gas bladders like strange wattles bulked out its throbbing body and detracted from its manoeuvrability, but were necessary to carry the extra weight of its arms and armour. These were not additional to the warrior, but integral. Like a great thunder lizard of primal earth, its weaponry was all built in. Except nature, in her wildest dreams, had never equipped anything like this. No, for this thing was of Scythus's fashioning.
"Well, Necroscope?" Charon's telepathic voice was suddenly shrill with alarm. "Running for it will simply delay things," he answered. "So?"
Panic was rising in her like the wind off Starside.
"So let's give it our best shot right here and now."
Overhead, a deadly arrowhead formation stooped on Charon's warrior like hawks to a pigeon. Harry ordered his flyer,
"Stay with your mistress,"
then rolled from his saddle through a hastily conjured Mobius door and emerged in the next moment on the scaled back of Charon's warrior, where he could almost taste the hot stench of the incoming warriors, that close.
"Slip side,"
he ordered his startled mount, and conjuring a massive door, he guided the monster through it. The enemy trio slammed together in a snarling knot where Harry had been, but now he came squirting out of the Mobius continuum far above them, on a level with the armoured flyer of Scythus and Shaitan. Even as his eyes met theirs across the gulf of air, so he picked up something of Scythus's telepathic ranting.
"You and your damn magic, you ordure of the hell lands!"
Harry was distracted. He'd looked into the scarlet eyes of Shaitan too, and the fallen one had looked burningly into his. No hatred in the mind of that great leech, no, not for the Necroscope, only an intense curiosity.
"Save your curses," he told Scythus, "for this one might yet do us great harm. Then you'll have real reason to curse him."
And Harry heard that too. Down below, the trio of confused warriors had unentangled themselves. Their propulsors roared as they commenced climbing again.
"Two of you," Scythus called to them, "to me, and hurry."
But to the third warrior,
"Get after the woman. You know what to do."
"Slimy bastard thing,"
Harry hurled the thought at Scythus before realizing it was no great insult. He looked for Charon's flyer and saw it turn out of the rising spiral to follow the mountains east. A pair of warriors, one of which was her own wounded creature, spurted in her wake. They clashed sporadically, fiercely in the sky. Charon's warrior was getting the worst of it, but her flyer was gaining time and distance. For the moment, Harry seemed to have lost the giant warrior. Chancing that Charon was in no immediate danger, he clung to the scales of his monstrous mount and sent it spurting head-on at his enemies. They turned tail and sped out over Starside's plains of boulders, heading roughly towards the broken eyries of the Vampiri. Now it became apparent that the flyers had the advantage of speed in level flight. Seeing that he couldn't hope to catch them this way, Harry conjured a door and guided his warrior through it, and emerged directly above the flyers, where they streamlined themselves and winged east. Scythus heard the warrior's howling propulsors, felt its shadow on his back, and looked up. The Necroscope's grin was scarlet, furious, as he slammed his mount down on Scythus's flyer and tried to crush him in his saddle. His target at once hurled himself flat on the shallow of his mount's shoulders. Harry's warrior extended grapples, pincers, retractable jaws, began cutting the flyer to pieces in midair. Its razor-sharp appendages came dangerously close to Scythus, where he squirmed for his life. Dripping the blood of its torn victim, Harry's warrior lifted up a little, again dashed all of its bulk down on the flyer, and slipping from his saddle to hang from its trappings in the scarlet rain, Scythus knew his beast was a goner.
"Shaitan!" he cried out where he dangled.
The great leech flew slightly below and to one side. "Jump!" he advised, passing directly underneath. Scythus made to leap, but his ancestor's flyer was thrown off course as, for the third time, Harry's warrior crashed down onto its mount's back, breaking it. And tumbling past Shaitan, Scythus found himself in freefall. It was a while since Scythus had flown in his own right, but he was in fine fettle and had more than sufficient height. His loose clothes ripped as he flattened himself into a prehistoric pterodactyl airfoil, and gradually his plummet slowed to a glide. Far to the east he spied a glowing beacon down on the boulder plain and knew it for the gate to the Helllands. It made a good marker, and he aimed himself in that direction. The necroscope had lost him. A dark speck in the darker sky, Scythus had vanished, but Shaitan remained to be dealt with. Meanwhile, that immemorial father of vampires had drawn ahead. Harry could cover the same distance in the time it took to conjure an equation. He made to do so, and his warrior was hit from behind. The shock almost tore him loose from the plates of his mounted back. Behind him, that most monstrous warrior of all gripped his creature in crab claws and tore out great chunks of meat from the musculature of its spluttering propulsive vents. Shaitan's other creatures stayed well back to let their far more monstrous cousin get on with its work. In the last few seconds, Karen had linked minds with Harry. She saw his problem, and he saw hers. The lesser warrior which Scythus had sent after her had dispatched her fighting creature and was now closing in on her flyer. To Karen, it all seemed ended.
"Necroscope, it's over," she sent. "My mounts are weakling, already winded. There's only myself to blame, for I designed him. I'd head for the furnace lands of a golden death in the rising sun, but doubt if we'd make it. Well, at least I'll go out honourably. A gauntlet against a warrior."
Riding Karen's last creature, where its mewling, slavering attacker shredded its way to him, the necroscope looked out through Karen's eyes. Her flyer heaved and panted where she drove it south for the Great Pass, for already its altitude was insufficient to carry it over the peaks. But spurting down on her from above and behind came that monster which Scythus had ordered.
"Get after the woman, you know what to do."
And directly down below, close to where the gash of the Great Pass split the mountains, that glaring light, Starside's Gate, of course. Harry would have known it at once, except this aerial view was new to him. In the next moment, turning that view red, the torn carcass of Karen's defeated warrior crashed down and burst into pieces, and its destroyer was falling on Karen even faster. Harry tumbled from his doomed creature's back through a Mobius door, stepped out into the foothills rising up from Starside's portal. The gate was a fault in the matter of the multiverse, a huge distortion in the fabric of Mobius space-time, but the necroscope was far enough away that it had little effect. He scanned the wide mouth of the pass where the enemy warrior was playing with Karen's exhausted flyer, forcing it down. A second flyer, riderless, flapped uselessly close by, Harry's mount, which he'd ordered to stay with his mistress. He took the Mobius route into its saddle and called to Karen.
"We're not done yet."
She heard him, but so did Scythus. At the end of his long, fast glide, he landed close to the gate and reformed into his man shape. And seeing his warrior in the sky where it menaced the flyers and their riders, he ordered it,
"Bring me the woman, in pieces, if that's the only way."
The warrior's response was immediate. It clashed its bulk down onto Karen's flyer and knocked her half out of the saddle. And while she reeled there and tried to recover her senses and balance both, it put out appendages with hooked claspers and snatched her up. Then, with its propulsors roaring triumphantly, the monster smashed down onto the riderless flyer one last time to break its neck. And as Karen's crippled beast spun and tumbled down out of the sky into the pass, so the warrior turned back towards the boulder plain.
"Good!"
Scythus applauded his beast.
"Bring her here to me."
Harry sent his mount plummeting from one high direction into the path of the warrior. Ignoring him, the thing came straight on. He sent, "Release her to me," directly into his small brain. "Do not," its rightful master counted his command. "Knock him aside, crush him if you can." The monster was upon Harry, Karen held fast in its pulps of chitin thorns, which pierced her flesh, holding her like a fish on 100 hooks, could only scream as its neck arched to strike at him, while jaws like a small cave, more lethally equipped than the mouth of a Tyrannosaurus Rex, opened to sweep him up. What happened next was all instinct. It was as if Faithor Ferenczi lived in the necroscope yet, and whispered in his ear,
"When he opens his great jaws at you, go in through them."
Harry knew he could never hope to cause this creature any real physical injury, not from the outside, but somewhere within that monstrous skull was a tiny brain, and somewhere inside himself something was or still desired to be Vampiri.
"Go in through them."
Harry stood up in the saddle, stepped into the stench of the warrior's mouth as it snapped shut on him. But within that door of teeth was another conjured from his metaphysical mind. He passed through that one, too, into the Mobius continuum, and out again within the warrior's head, physically inside its head. Among the rude materials of its cranium, the pulsing pipes and conduits, knobs and nodules, muck and mucous membranes of its living skull. He felt the cringing of displaced mush, the shrinking of metamorphic flesh as his body materialized to rub against raw nerve endings and wet, spongy tissues, and the throb of plasma carrying oxygen to the small, agonized brain, then reached out with tearing, taloned vampire hands to find and fondle the central ganglion itself and to crush it into so much pulp. Then gravity disappeared as the warrior's propulsors closed down and the thing went into freefall. And inside its head, Harry desperately sought to make room for himself and to conjure a Mobius door. He needed space to work in, air to breathe. He had never before attempted a door underwater or surrounded by viscous solids, namely blood. But now he must conjure a door, get out of here, rescue Karen from this dead thing's claws before it hit the ground. But even as Mobius Math commenced mutating on the screen of the necroscope's mind, so he saw how alien, how inescapably wrong it was. The door pulsed and vibrated, but wouldn't firm into being. Instead, its energies fastened upon the region of space on the perimeter of its matrix and violently reshaped it. And common matter, displaced from its natural shape and form, flowed like magmas in the moment before the aborted door exploded into nothingness. Scythus saw his creature tumbling to earth and for a moment thought it must fall into the gate. Astonished, he saw its armored head warp and melt and burst open even before it crashed down only a few paces from the dimensional portal. And as it hit, he saw something manlike, but red, yellow, and slime-grey, vomited from the shattered skull and hurled out onto the boulder plain. As the dust settled and the last gobs of slime and plasma arced down to slop among the rocks and the dirt, so he went forward. Shielding his eyes against the glare, he stepped wonderingly among the debris of his warrior and gazed at the Lady Karen, bruised and bleeding and unconscious in the thing's claspers. And upon the broken, disjointed Hellander, Harry Keogh, as bloody a sight as the vampire lord ever saw. But not yet dead, no, not by a long shot.
"Of course you're not," Scythus thought, "for he is Vampiri, and yet different and hard to understand."
"Indeed," Shaitan agreed, as he glided his flyer to earth. "And yet that is what we must do, understand him. For his mind contains all the secrets of the gate and the worlds beyond it. So do him no harm, but let him heal himself as best he can. And when he can answer me, then I shall question him." Betrayed by his own talent when he attempted to materialize a Mobius door too close to the gate, the necroscope's metaphysical mind had taken the brunt of the shock. His flesh was vampire and would repair itself in time, even the core of his damaged brain, but until then he must remain largely oblivious, and to some extent perhaps he was lucky at that. Karen, on the other hand, was not nearly so broken, and by no means so lucky. While Shaitan concerned himself with Harry, his dark descendant's only thought was Karen. Both of them sought knowledge, in the latter's case, carnal. Shaitan's examination was telepathic. As Harry's mind healed and shards of splintered memory slowly cemented themselves together, so the fallen one extracted what information was of value to him. Certain concepts were difficult. Where a memory had been too complicated or too painful for detailed retention, Harry had kept it in outline only. For example, the underground complex at Perchosk, which he'd always considered a dark, brooding fortress. His mental images of the Perchosk project were starkly monochrome. What memories he retained of the place, their mood and texture, were not unlike those of some menacing eerie. He shied from filling in details. Penny was the reason, of course, for even in his damaged condition, Harry couldn't bring Perchosk to mind without her intrusion. But of Harry's life prior to Perchosk, and the world of men in general, Shaitan had gauged much, sufficient to be sure that when he went through the gate and invaded, first the underground complex, and making it his impregnable fortress, and then the rest of the Necroscope's world, little would stand before him. His army of vampire servitors would spread out insidiously through all of the earth, and his dark disciples would carry his plague into every part until he reigned supreme, even as he had sought to reign in that far dim dawn which he was not permitted to remember. And each time Shaitan thought that then he would go to where Harry lay upon a traveller's blanket close to their fire, gaze on him anew, and wonder where he'd seen that vaguely familiar face before. In what far land, in what dim and unremembered time, in what previous existence? He wondered, too, about the Necroscope's strange powers, amazing powers which he alone possessed, brought with him out of an alien world. With his own ancient but trustworthy eyes, Shaitan had seen him move instantaneously from place to place, but without crossing the distance between. Yes, he had come through the gate from the world beyond, almost as if he had fallen from the one into the next, as Shaitan had once fallen. And from the same world? Possibly, except Shaitan had forgotten, for they, but who, had robbed him of all such memories. The Necroscope's fellow men had cast him out, even as Shaitan was cast out of that time before the Vampiri exiled him, causing him to flee here for his differences, so that in a way the father of vampires even felt a weird kinship with the Necroscope. And when Harry's mind was repaired a little, Shaitan entered it again to ask him, "Do I know you? Where have I seen you before? Are you of their order who expelled me from my rightful place?" Harry's mind was frequently coherent in its limbo. He knew he was addressed, even knew something of the one who addressed him, and the meaning of his question, and, "No," he answered to all three. Shaitan tried again. "I have heard your thoughts. In them you wonder about strange worlds beyond common ken, but in spaces between the spaces. Indeed, you have access to just such an invisible space, where you move more surely and speedily than a fish in water. I too would move there, in the darkness which is not of the world. Show me how." It had been the Necroscope's best-kept secret, but damaged in mind and body, he could no longer keep it. And if he should try, the fallen one's mental hypnosis would unlock the mystery anyway. And so he showed Shaitan the computer screen of his mind, where Mobius equations at once commenced mounting to a crescendo. Shaitan saw, felt, warned, was afraid. "Stop," he commanded, when the faintest pulse of a tortured Mobius door began to form out of nothing in his mind. And as the screen was wiped clean and the unformed door imploded into itself, so the great leech sighed his relief and was pleased to remove himself from Harry. For having felt the energies emanating from those equations and surrounding that door, he suspected that indeed he had known them before in a world beyond, where they'd been part and parcel of his downfall. And now Shaitan knew that Harry's secret place was forever beyond him, and the knowledge angered him. What? Kinship? with this puling babe, this infant in the dark arts, this bruised and bloodied, unblooded innocent? He must be mad even to have dreamed it. Anyway, what did it matter that there were forbidden invisible places? The visible ones would do for starters, and one at a time would suffice. Now that Starside had fallen, the world beyond the gate, the Necroscope's own world, would be next. And entry into that place would be soon, before sunup, between times. Shaitan knew all he needed to know from the Necroscope. Scythers could have him now. Let the so-called Helllanders suffer a vampire's agony and death, and him and all his mysteries go up in fire and smoke, and so be at an end. Such were the Fallen One's thoughts, which he allowed to go out from himself. But inside him there were deeper currents, fit and well. This Harry Keogh had been a force. If he should live, he could become a force again, even a power, which was why Scythus, if he had any vision at all, would be wise to deal with him with dispatch. Aye, before Shaitan dealt with him in his turn. From the Necroscope's point of view, or rather to his traumatized perceptions, events revolved in an endless round of nausea and drifting confusion, semi-conscious agony, and a waking hell of blurred vision, haunting flashes of incomplete memories, and vivid but all too frequently meaningless bursts of input. Sometimes, while his metamorphic flesh worked hard to heal both body and brain, his mind seemed part of a morbid merry-go-round, turning on its own axis and reviewing the same scenes over and over.